So how is it all going anyway? I see you working pretty hard on the campaign trail.
There's a saying that the harder you work, the luckier you get.
Yeah.
And it's true. You've got to go and door knock houses and speak to people, listen to what they're concerned about, and just try and work out ways to help.
Yeah.
And you've got to be able to reach people through, you know, obviously social media, going to shopping centres, door knocking, cooking a barbie for the local bushfire brigade
this morning.
Yeah, bacon and eggs, that always goes down well for a volunteer bushfire brigade in Mount Helena, which was really good fun. Before that, I was out sign waving in Rolleystone.
Yeah.
After this, I'll go and do some door knocking, and then I'm off to the Mundaring markets. So it's busy, but it's enjoyable, and the key is just to listen.
Yeah, I'll get to that. I want to ask you a bit about what you're sort of hearing in politics. We'll get to that. But kind of first things, I like to ask people generally on the podcast, I don't know if you listen to that and what or not, but you probably don't have time at the moment. But, yeah, I like to sort of ask people a bit about where they grew up, where they went to school, and then a bit about the army, and then we'll, like, wrap up with politics at the end. So you're basically a hills guy, eh? So you grew up in Boya, is that right?
I was born in Kalamunda.
Oh, born in Kalamunda.
Born in Kalamunda.
Kalamunda Hospital.
Yep, 1980.
Do they still do that?
Well, it's changed a lot since, no. So it's changed a lot since I was there. So 1980, born in Kalamunda. I grew up in Boya, live in Kalamunda now. But my family has been in this area for generations. My grandfather was the Shire Clerk in Coolgardie, and then they moved to Kalamunda. And he was actually the secretary of the Darling Range Roads Board back then, I think in the 50s and 60s. And he was in charge of that. Lived on Sampson Close in Kalamunda for a long time, but died in office, actually. So he died in the late 60s. And my nan stayed in the same house on Sampson Close for many, many years until she died in that house back in 2010. My dad taught at Gooseberry Hill Primary School. A lot of my uncle Peter was the local plumber in Kalamunda, so a lot of people know him there. In fact, I had one guy, this couple, as I was door knocking around Kalamunda, they saw me in my blue Matt Moran shirt, and they went, "Are you related to Patrick Moran, the former Shire Clerk?" And usually it's me saying to them, "Oh, my grandfather was the Shire, you might know him." And I said, yes, that was my granddad. And he goes, "I was a junior accountant working for him in the mid-1960s. So the family name, the Moran family name, is still well known in the area. And he's got a stand named after him, the Patrick Moran Pavilion at Kostira Oval.
Oh, really?
There's a few streets around the place. So
I didn't know that.
Yeah, so I mean, the family has been here for a long, long time. My auntie owns Dreams in Kalamunda, which is a famous sort of gift shop in town. And my other auntie and uncle still live in town. So, yeah, so it's the connection has been there for a long time, and it's coming back to Kalamunda is like coming home.
Yeah. So where did you go to primary school then?
St. Anthony's in Greenmount.
Bullwinkle
covers Greenmount as well.
That's right, yeah. So what was that school like?
I loved it. In fact, actually, I door knocked around Greenmount just a couple of weeks ago. It was so funny because the door knocking area was quite close to the school. So you had the school and the church right next to each other.
Yeah.
And people in that suburb remembered me from primary school. And I knocked on one door and I said, "G'day, I'm just introducing myself. I'm Matt Moran." And they went, "Oh, yeah, we know you, Matt. You went to school with Ryan." I said, "Oh, hello." And then they invited me in to have a chat for half an hour.
Or roughly probably about the same age. And yeah, so is that kind of like in the sort of half set in the bush, isn't it? St. Andrews?
St. Anthony's is right near right near Black Boy Hill in Greenmount.
Okay. Oh, right. Wow. That's a pretty famous spot.
It is. Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. And then, so what about high school?
I went to LaSalle College, which is in Vivash, and that's just outside of Bullwinkle.
Right. Did you commute every day?
Yeah. I caught the bus. I think it was the 322 from Scott Street in Boyer, Helena Valley area every day, up Scott Street, down Great Eastern Highway to Midland train station.
So what made you pick that? Or did your folks pick it?
The school.
School, yeah.
Well, they said to me, you got a choice, Mazenod, Trinity or LaSalle. But all my mates from primary school were going to LaSalle. So I went, okay, I'll go to LaSalle.
Yeah, kind of mate. So that's a pretty good choice. What was that school like?
It was fine. I liked it. It was a good teachers.
So it's private.
It was a private Catholic, but it wasn't. It was not. It was not an expensive school. It was a reasonable school, but the teachers were good. But interesting, my parents were both teachers, but I never went to school where they taught.
Okay. Oh, that's interesting. So because Wesley, a lot of people would have gone for that, but that's pretty expensive.
Yeah, well, my parents were both teachers, so we didn't have that sort of money to do that.
Yeah, so you kind of had the private school. And so then, after high school, you get into year 12, and then it's like, what happens next?
Yeah. Well, I decided I went to Curtin University and did a Bachelor of Arts, and I wanted to keep my options open. So there was a program called a Special Purpose Program, which you studied social sciences, journalism, and a bit of commerce, marketing. So I did that.
That's an unusual combination.
Yeah, it was a Bachelor of Arts. And I then specialised in the journalism side and got really interested in that.
Right, okay. And so then, you get your bachelor, you finish that, you went to Curtin, so we know roughly what that was like. Pretty good uni. My mate went to Curtin. And so then what after that? So then did you have any inkling during that time what you wanted to do, or did it just kind of happen?
I got into journalism and I liked it. And just the teamwork aspect of working together as a team, I enjoyed. And then I went, worked for a company called 8M Media and Communications, which was doing some work for SBS Radio. So I did that. That was my first job. And then worked for the Australia Day Council of WA. Very early days of that, back in the early 2000s. And then my first real proper journalism role was as a rural reporter with the ABC in Esperance. So I dealt with a lot of farmers down there. So I was there for 18 months.
Yeah, so you moved down there.
Yep.
Yeah, what was that like?
I loved it.
Yeah. Was that your first taste of anything like that?
Well, my family has a background in farming, but it was the first time I'd already moved out of home.
Yeah.
But it was my first time running your own radio program, interviewing farmers every morning. So it was a breakfast show every day.
Okay.
And I did stuff for the Country Hour. Yeah. So I did reports for that. I was there for about 18 months.
Is that a bit of a dying field these days?
Rural reporting?
Oh, yeah, or radio, that kind of thing.
I think radio has a real, really important role to play, because I think, especially in the bush, the Country Hour is important. It's a way that people stay connected.
The only thing that works.
Yeah, well, I love radio, and it really connects you to the audience. But then I left radio, and then I went to work at Channel 10 in Perth.
Yeah, okay, yeah. So I saw that on you. So you're looking that up, and so that would kind of seem like a natural progression to me, for any kind of person coming up. I've had a few friends do the same thing, start radio in the country, and then what was that like working with Channel 10?
It's different. Like back then, 2004, television still had some money. Channel 10 was doing pretty well. Australian Idol had just come out. And I really enjoyed it. A lot more pressure. But you're right, there is a natural progression. A lot of people who start out in journalism go to the regions, go to the country first, and then they progress. But I was young. I was 24 on television. But it was fun, met a lot of good people, learnt a lot, and it was just an interesting insight into people's lives. You see the best in people, you see the worst in people. You go to crime scenes, car crashes, house fires, court cases.
Okay.
It's all there.
Yeah, right. And so how did you do that for?
I was at Channel 10 for 12 years.
12 years?
But I joined the army in 2005, so I'd had some stints of doing full-time army services.
Okay, so while you were there, you joined the army.
Yeah, I joined the army in 2004 as a reservist. deployed to East Timor in 2007, just for a month. Did a short media escort tour in Solomon Islands in 2008. I think it wasn't for long. It was only like a couple of days or a week or whatever. But then the big trip I did was in 2009, when I deployed to Afghanistan for 8 months. And I remember going into my boss's office and saying, and two outcomes were going to happen. Either I was going to politely ask for leave without pay for a year, or I was going to resign. And he gave me leave without pay to then go to Townsville and do my pre-deployment training with 1 hour to then deploy for 8 months to Afghanistan.
Okay. Yeah, I was going to ask you, so where did you do your training? So that's the Darwin, isn't it?
So Townsville. I did my SSO course at Duntroon, which is a short course, to be a public affairs officer.
Do they still do basic training at Kabuka?
For officers, you do Duntroon.
Right.
Yeah, I only did
that's Canberra.
Yeah, I only did.
Yeah, I've been there.
I remember it was so cold when I did mine. It was like I wore pretty much every piece of clothing I could on overnight picket. It was so cold.
So that's basically like an officer's uni kind of thing.
Well, you know, like it's called the knife, fork and spoon course. That's what they call it in the army. Right. It's essentially to get doctors, lawyers, public affairs officers, dentists and others to know how to march, how to use a rifle, how to do first aid. And I loved it. I really enjoyed my time, very short period of time. Like I was a good shot. I could march. Like I enjoyed it. And basic tactics was good.
There's been a lot of stuff said about Duntroon. What would you say about that?
Oh, I had a good time there. Yeah. I mean, I wasn't there very long.
Yeah. I think these things tend to be small and isolated and they get blown up. And a lot of people don't realise, so for every person on the front lines, I don't know, what is the ratio? It's got to be like, is it like 9 or 10?
What's that, sorry?
Behind the scenes, like people that are doing all those sort of other roles.
I'm not sure what
that's most of the people, but isn't it?
I'm not sure the numbers, but there's a lot of support staff that help out, yeah, that do a lot of amazing work behind the scenes.
Okay, so you go do that, so then you go to Timor. And what was Timor like? Tell me like an average day-to-day.
I still remember vividly, actually, it was the International Stabilization Force in Timor. It was after there was some more trouble and I went over. I was fill-in for a month, basically, while the other guy that was full-time had a break. I still remember the headquarters. I mean, it was okay. Like, we still had sentry posts. The danger had essentially passed. But we still had sentry posts. You still, whenever you went outside the wire, you still had your machine gun, you know, your Steyr. But you know, it was fine. The people were friendly, but I still remember the headquarters, and it had like these signs all over the headquarters that said danger of asbestos everywhere. And I'm like, this isn't good. So I remember taking a photo of me in front of this sign thinking maybe one day this photo might be helpful.
Yeah. Hopefully not. Oh man, I've been in training for a long time. So worked in plenty of houses as long as you don't touch it, generally it's pretty good. So yeah, okay. And so what was your actual role? Like, is that public affairs?
So public affairs officer, essentially what that is you're an advisor to the commander. You deal with crisis management, issues management. If someone is killed, you're involved in that process. In Afghanistan, you know, I went out on patrol with people like Andrew Hastie. He deployed with me.
Yeah. Well, I was going to ask you about that. The difference between the two places on the two roles, or were they essentially the same?
The roles were similar, but the intensity is vastly different. Because if in Timor, like you could get in a four-wheel drive and, you know, as long as you're with someone else, you could pretty much go anywhere and you'd be fine.
Yeah.
In Afghanistan, you don't leave the wire without bulletproof vests.
Yeah, so when you said you went on patrol, you kind of just candidly said that. But yeah, I've got friends that were over there. I know what that means. Can you explain that to like people listening? Like, what's that like when you step outside that
way? I remember it vividly. The first time I did it, you know, I'm not an infantry soldier or officer, right? So my job is not that all the time. But on occasion, when your job needs you to go out on patrol,
you
do it, right? And you've got to have the training to do it. I just remember stepping outside the wire and going, this is what you're here for. You've been trained to do it. Don't let your mates down. Just crack on and get it done. And I didn't question it. I didn't think about it. my biggest fear is like an IED. The danger is what you can't see. You're walking around, you know, and I didn't do it as much as the guys of infantry at all, but that's what you're concerned about. But you're there to help your mates, you're there to serve your nation, and you're there just to get on with it. And, you know, on the occasion when I did go out, I was fortunate. There was no incident. There's a photo of me patrolling in the Baluchi Valley in my office. It's got a camel on one side, me in the middle, and an Afghan just off to the other side. And it's a reminder about service, and that's what motivates me.
Yeah. Do you think, going back to when you said you just don't think about it, do you think that's how most people deal with it over there, or are people kind of like, I'm curious to know, are people dealing with it in different ways?
Maybe. I think it probably affects different people in different ways, especially at the after their service, depending on what they saw or went through. I didn't have any of those issues. I didn't see anything bad. I was fortunate.
But did you see a lot of people that did have
people? A lot of people have issues after they come back from Afghanistan or any deployment.
And what do you think about, like, you know, someone who sort of knows these kind of people? Like, what I'm curious in getting at is really, is there the proper help, like, available for these people, do you think? Or is it kind of a bit blown out of the proportion in the media?
I think we can always do more to help our veterans. That's one of the motivations of why I joined the RSL and why I was elected to the board of the RSL in WA. So veterans around the state elected me as their representative on the board, and I got a four-year term. And my motivation is to help veterans that need help, but we need to remember that not all veterans are broken. I remember my uncle was in the Korean War with the British Army, and he was with the Rhodesian Army. And I had his commissioning scroll from the Rhodesian Army on my wall. And I used to look at it and just be really proud to know that, you know, my uncle, Second Lieutenant Gorman, served in the Korean War and in the Rhodesian Army, and used to look up at those veterans, Second World War veterans and all of that, and just used to look at them and go, wow, they're amazing. Like, so much respect for them. And I think we need to understand and respect our veterans, help the ones that need to be helped. My motivation for joining the RSL was to try and help the veterans that need support. DVA has got a lot of criticism about making it difficult for veterans, and I think we need to really look at making treatment easier and access to help and support easier. You don't want to re-traumatise people by making it difficult for them to get help.
Yeah, that's part of the problem at the moment, resources as well. So then you come back from, so how long are you in Afghanistan for?
So I was there from like middle 2009 to early 2010. But the interesting and sad ending of my trip, I get a call from my brother. So I'd done my full 8 months, and this is on the Sunday night. I meant to fly out from Afghanistan like a few days later. And he calls me and says, Nan's dying. So Nan's in her 90s. This is the Nan I was talking about from Kalamunda, Samson Close. And he goes, you need to get home if you can quickly. And I'm like, well, I'm meant to leave like in a few days. So I went to my CO. I said, sir, my Nan's about to die. Can I leave a few days earlier to get to see her? And he goes, right, you're on the next plane out of here. Wow. He presented me my medals in his office. I jump on a chopper to get, I think, to Kandahar to then get back to Darwin and then back to Perth. And I'm getting this chopper, and all of a sudden the chopper started doing evasive maneuvers in the air and firing flares. And I'm like, what is going on here? I cannot get killed leaving Afghanistan to see my Nan. That's not cool. Yeah. That's not in the script. No, nothing's in the script. Life, it doesn't have a script. Anyway, so this chopper is doing evasive maneuvers, and I'm going, what is going on here? Anyway, we nothing happens, and we land in Kandahar, I think it was. And I said, mate, what was going on? Why were you firing flares and doing evasive maneuvers like we were getting rocketed? And he goes, oh, yeah, sorry. there was a photographer in the other chopper and we were just getting some photos. I said, do you think you could have told me that before we took off, mate? So, and we, anyway, I end up, I land in Perth and my brother picks me up from the airport and Nan's still alive, just. We go straight to Samson Close in Kalamunda. I see her, I hold her hand, she's still alive. You know, I say, Nan, I love you. She dies that morning. That was my homecoming from Afghanistan. A funeral, no decompression training or anything, but that's just the way it goes.
Wow. Fuck. That's pretty heavy. Yeah, okay. How old was she?
She was early 90s. Right. Yeah, so well, she would have been... She died in 2010 and she was born sort of, you know, 1916 or so something
like that. Right, yeah, okay. Yeah, it's kind of like, it's one of those things, it's like, it's sad when it happens, but it's like, you couldn't really ask for probably much better of a life, really.
She was so with it, healthy, loved the Eagles, loved tennis, you know, great sense of humour. She came from station family, the Crawfords that owned Carbine Station out past Coolgardie. So, you know, she was always a hard worker and stayed in the same house till she died. When she moved to Kalamunda, it would have been back in probably the 50s or so, because Dad was born in Coolgardie in 1940. And then, so then, yeah, they moved from Coolgardie to Kalamunda.
Thinking about it, Coolgardie 1940.
It was, you know, the Coolgardie's safe. It was hot. It was hot.
You try to explain to people that, like, haven't been there, it's like, I just tell people it's no place for humans.
I haven't spent much time there, but it was a bustling place back in the day.
For 6 months of the year, it's magic. But for 3 months of the year, yeah, you don't want to be there. So, okay, wow. So then you come back and then do you have any other plans now, or like now you're back to Channel Town or what?
Yeah, I mean, I got back, to be honest, I got back from Afghanistan and I just was like, I'm just happy to be alive. And I went back and, yeah, went back to Channel 10, sort of doing some chief of staffing work. I just wasn't really that interested about being on television. I actually liked helping other people and being chief of staff or leading them. But I was still in the army. I then came back and was posted to the SASR as their public affairs officer. So when Ben Robert Smith was awarded his Victoria Cross, I helped in that investiture ceremony. When Andrew Hastie did his SAS selection course, I was behind the scenes on that and saw all that happen because SBS filmed a documentry on that.
Yeah, I've seen that.
So I was there behind the scenes.
Very interesting. Yeah. It's super interesting. That's a whole other podcast.
It's quite incredible what they go through.
Yeah.
Andrew passed. And then I got a call from the boss in Channel 10 and said, hey, what about you come to Canberra and work in the Canberra Bureau for Channel 10 in the press gallery?
Okay, so that's how that happened, because that was my next question. So how did you get from here to Canberra?
That's what happened. They thought with your experience.
And was that attractive to you, obviously?
Yeah. Yeah. I've always been interested in politics.
Yeah. Is that ever since you were a kid even? Did you have those, you know, when you say you're always interested, or did it come later?
I was always interested in the military as a kid. I was always interested in drawing and art. Like, I loved art. I've won a lot of art awards in primary school and high school. It was not in high school. And so a lot of people were confused as to why I didn't go and do fine art at uni. But I didn't see much of a profession there other than a hobby.
It's hard to make money.
Yeah. So I went to Canberra because I was interested in politics. And I remember meeting John Howard back in the mid to late 90s when he'd just become Prime Minister. It would have been like 96 or 97. And I said to him, Prime Minister, what's your advice for someone who's interested in politics? And he said, have a career, work out what you believe and join a party. And ultimately that's what I did.
Interesting advice. Yeah, so you would have been pretty young still then?
Yeah, 1996, I was 16. And, yeah, so then with the press gallery, I was there I wasn't there long. I said to my colonel in the army, I said, "Sir, I might have to do some stories on the military now I'm in Canberra, so I'm going to have to take a step back from the military. I can't do report, like I can't
be objective.
I need to be objective." And then 2 months later, I broke the biggest story of the year in Canberra and won pretty much every journalism award in Australia. And that was pretty life-changing.
Yeah, so let's touch on that briefly. So how did... Tell me a little bit about that and how that came about.
She literally called... It was a Skype scandal. She called Channel 10 in Sydney, and she called other TV stations, but they all were disinterested or they just brushed her off. But Sydney said, "Oh, this sounds interesting, Matt. Give her a call, see what you reckon." I called her. I said, "I think she's telling the truth. I think she's a credible witness.
I saw something
no one else did, and the other stations didn't. I mean, obviously one of my producers did as well." And I went out and interviewed her in uniform, and then the rest is history.
Yeah, wow. Okay, so just following it up, really.
No one else gave her the time of day, and I did, and listened. And that led to a series of changes within the Defence Force that is being felt today.
That's right. Yeah, that's interesting, because like often the eyewitness thing is always kind of just poo-pooed. But to me, like, I don't know, I place a certain amount of weight on any kind of eyewitness report, you know what I mean?
You've got to listen to people and understand and have empathy. Yeah. Make your own decisions about whether it's true, valid. And, you know, everyone makes mistakes. But she just wanted some kind of justice at the time. And, you know, she got what she wanted. I mean, the people involved were charged and convicted. But, you know, that's a long time ago, and I hope they're all doing well now.
Yeah. Yeah, it's pretty crazy. So then, because eventually you go back and work for the Department of Defence, is that correct?
So I stayed at Channel 10 until 2015, and then Julie Bishop wanted me to work for her as one of her policy advisors when she was foreign minister. That didn't end up happening. But when Malcolm Turnbull became prime minister,
So that's 2016.
2015.
Or 15, was it?
Yeah. So then when Malcolm Turnbull became prime minister, I became one of his media advisors.
And what do you think of Canberra? What do you think of Canberra, just living there in general?
They say if you are in Canberra for more than 4 years, you never leave. I was there for 8 really? And I got out. I liked it. I mean, Canberra's, it's really hot in summer. It's really cold in winter.
Yeah.
But it's got great food, great wine, great people. It's really like it's the heart of decision-making in Australia. Like it's got all the diplomatic posts. It's got the military. It's got the media. It's got politics. It's interesting.
It's kind of it's a bit of an enigma. So yeah, I was born in Canberra. I lived there till I was about 10 or 12. And yeah, there's nothing else kind of quite like it. But yeah, isn't that funny? It's 4 years and you never get out.
Let's say if there was a beach in Canberra, it'd be like a million or more people.
It definitely, oh yeah.
Can you imagine if that was there?
Well, you know the story about that, where it was a million and all that. So yeah, that's true. And it's a nice place, but I don't know. I don't know. It attracts like a lot of good people, but it attracts a lot of other people as well. Also, you know, and not my favorite type of. So yeah, okay. So then I want to talk a little bit about when you go back and work for the Department of Defence. So then obviously you worked for a couple of politicians. How long was that for?
So I worked for Turnbull for about a year. Learned a lot, but I was. You know, it's all when someone offers you the opportunity to work for the Prime Minister of Australia.
Yeah, for sure.
You say yes. Yeah. I was a Liberal. He's a Liberal Prime Minister. I said yes. Then after the 2016 election, I then went and worked for the Defence Industry Minister So then that was the transition point to policy. I was then a policy advisor. I left media behind. and then was promoted to senior advisor to the Minister for Defence Industry, and then eventually I became senior advisor, one of the senior advisors to the Defence Minister, right, when Pine became Defence Minister.
Okay, so Pine. Yeah, I was going to ask you because I couldn't remember who that was. But I'll tell you something interesting about that election, right? What a lot of people forget, right? Old mate Bill Shortnuts. So the bookies paid out the day before, right? A lot of people forget that, right? And at the moment, right, like they got you guys 11-1. And like as someone who's like, I'm going to sound like a wanker, but I haven't missed an election since probably the 80s, right? I just don't see 10-1. Like I just do not see it, you know? And people forget, even so, the Trump-Hillary election, same thing happened. Bookies paid out the day before. They were so confident that Hillary had won, and then they actually started counting the votes. And people forget that with the Turnbull election, yeah, that it was all over and done until they started counting on Saturday. And that's kind of what I love about democracy, you know? It's like, yeah, and at the moment, like even polls, you know, the new poll came out yesterday, but the problem with it is the sample data is so small. It's like 1,000, maybe. That's it. So, okay. So, and what was that like working as an advisor? Is there a lot of people on that, or is it just a few of you?
No, the Prime Minister's office is pretty big. Defence Minister's office was smaller.
How many people would be in your department, sort of?
Maybe in the actual Defence Minister's office, like, I don't know, 10 to 15, maybe, like advisors. And then he's got an electorate office separate to that. So you've got ministerial staff, electorate staff. But, you know, Pine was a very good minister. He held the department to account. He was very smart. And I learned a lot from his other staff. Like when I first started there, one of the senior advisors just said, go and meet people and listen and just get to know people. And it was great advice. Because we became an office that people knew they could come and talk to. We would always return phone calls. We would always listen to them. You know, we tried to help and create local jobs and build the defence industry. Unfortunately, the defence industry is not in a good shape now as a result of Labor's mismanagement.
Yeah, I was going to say at the moment. But you see in America, they just had their most recruited day for 15 years the other day, and kind of not surprised because, well, a lot of people over there probably realize that there's not going to be any wars for a while. So, because Trump is definitely, you can say what you like about him, but he's definitely anti-war. So, yeah, so that would be a unique experience to work in a department like that because you're tapping into, yeah, a lot of resources there. And yeah, I think what you said, you made a good point, you know, because I've always got a saying too, right? If you're talking, you're not learning. So, yeah, being able to tap into that, that's what would make me curious. I never did the whole Canberra thing, but, I got close a couple of times, and even in the army, like I was as close as you could be to being in the army. Well, actually being in the army.
One of the best decisions I ever made in my life was to join the army.
Yeah, I think about it sometimes. I just, more from a point of view, I wonder how different my life kind of would have been.
I wouldn't be sitting here talking to you if I didn't join the army.
No, well, that's right.
And the other interesting thing that, so I deployed to Afghanistan as a public affairs officer, and then I went back to Afghanistan as a journalist a few years after that. So when Kevin, you know, when Kevin Rudd became Prime Minister for the second time,
oh, yeah,
he did a flying, like literally 40-hour trip to Afghanistan to be on the ground like for a couple of hours. And I was one of the journos that went with him. And so I went back to Afghanistan as a journo and saw some of the people I originally deployed with in the army.
Wow.
And then I went to Iraq with Malcolm Turnbull when I was a media advisor to him. So in the end, I ended up going to Timor, Solomons, Afghanistan twice, Iraq, all in sort of different roles. It was quite a privilege and an honour to be able to see the amazing work that we were doing overseas.
It's a crazy amount of varied experience. You know what I mean? Like, yeah, especially for someone so such young age, and that's kind of what fascinates me. You've been able to get a bit of an insight into a lot of different things, and yeah, being objective is one of the things I try and teach my son, you know.
And the other thing is that I've seen policy and government decisions from every angle. I've seen it in the uniform, I've seen it as a journo, I've seen it in business, I've seen it as a very senior public servant, and now I've seen it as a candidate. So, and you know, I'm sure we're going to get into what I did after that as well.
So let's go there, because we've got a little bit to go, but then we'll start wrapping it up. So what makes you, well, first of all, so how did you become, what led to this, to become the federal candidate?
So after Pine retired, he left, I wanted to move back to WA. So I moved back to WA when he was still minister, and then I was offered the job when he finished to be the inaugural executive director of Defence West, which was a state government defence industry agency. So to build up the team, we were trying to get like full cycle docking of submarines in town, and I brought on veterans issues. So we looked after veterans in Defence West. So I was the executive director and built an amazing team. I'm still in a WhatsApp actually with a group of my colleagues from Defence West when I was their boss. They're all still, literally pretty much every day, it's still active. Yeah. So we had a really close-knit group. Yeah, but it was a good team. I employed most of them. And I was there for a couple of years, and then I was offered a job at Lursen Australia as head of strategy and government relations, and that's shipbuilding down in Henderson.
Yeah, that's a big company.
And I was there for about 3 years and resigned that job to then become the candidate.
So, right. Yeah, okay. And so, let's talk about Bullwinkle first of all. I want to say is, what the fuck? Like, who came up with Bullwinkle? Like, do you know what I mean? Like, someone says to you, oh, what's your federal seat? You want to, like, you know, say, you know, O'Connor or Fraser or one of these, like, no, we're Bullwinkle.
Well, what do you reckon? I mean, it's named after Vivian Bullwinkle. The AEC obviously decides the names.
I know, but people don't.
I explained it, and when I explained the name of the origins, they were like, it's okay, it's pretty amazing. So Vivian Bullwinkle, nurse, she was involved in the Banker Island massacre, where the Japanese marched all the soldiers and nurses out into the sea and machine gunned them all. She was shot, but the only reason she survived was because she was tall, the bullet didn't hit a vital organ. She then played dead, was eventually captured by the Japanese, stayed a prisoner of war, survived, luckily, never mentioned the massacre because if she did, she would have been killed, and then became a veterans advocate and a very famous nurse after the Second World War, and that's where the name comes from. So I'm very proud to be a candidate in an electorate named after her. And she didn't have kids. Her closest living relative is a guy called John Bullwinkle. And I reached out to him, and we caught up for dinner outside of Canberra a while ago, and he brought her medals. So she handed all her medals to him, and I heard more about her story. And she was obviously an amazing lady, and to meet John and to talk about her story and to see her miniature medals was pretty special. And her full-size medals are in the War Memorial.
Yeah, okay. I think I've seen them there. Yeah, look, I was pulling the piss at the start, obviously.
No.
But I wanted people to understand where it actually does come from, and it's a legitimate, it's a good name. Look, I find it's a unique opportunity. It's kind of like, I wouldn't say a fresh start, but in some ways it kind of is, because the boundaries are being changed. They're quite a bit bigger now. So, what do you see as the main issues for the seat going into the next election? Because you've been knocking on a lot of doors, you're getting a lot of feedback. What are people saying?
Cost of living, housing, mobile phone coverage, roads. I mean, the bins, local government bins.
FOGO,
people are frustrated with that.
You know what? I'm surprised no one's campaigning on FOGO, because considering how much talk it gets on social media.
There's a lot of talk about FOGO. I make the point that people don't care whether there are problems local, state or federal. They just want a problem solved. Mm. And you need to be able to help that. So, yeah, they're the biggest issues that
I think. Cost of living, housing, well.
Buying a house.
And housing's fucking out of control.
It's ridiculous. You know, I was door knocking in Forestfield yesterday, and they're paying for like a very standard three-bedroom house, maybe four-bedroom, $650 a week.
Yeah, it's ridiculous. And the shortage. And the problem with, Labor's short-sightedness is like they top up the inflation numbers with immigration. But the problem is, not enough houses, and then you've got this problem with not enough tradies coming through. Like, so I'm a tradie, and like trying to get people at the moment, and like honestly, the amount of money that I've been offered to go and do some jobs is just insane. And like, here's the thing, unfortunately for them, Matt, I couldn't care less about money, right? Because once you get to my age and you nearly died a couple of times, you don't really care about money anymore. But yeah, and you know, the TAFE thing annoys me, right? Because, you know, I saw Labor spruiking a thing the other week, right? Saying, oh, free TAFE, right? And I was like, there's not one fucking journo in that crowd, right, that asked the proper question, right? How many spots are there, right? Because you can say free TAFE all you like, right? And the sheep will probably buy some of that, right? But anybody who knows, who looks into it, just knows that we need bums on seats at the moment. And like, for example, apprentices, right? I know for a fact, right? I won't delve my sources, but one of the northern TAFEs, there's about spots for about 50 or 60 electricians, right? They had over 500 applications. So people are blaming the kids, saying, oh, these kids don't want to work. Man, I don't think so. There was 500 kids in the northern suburbs who were just out of high school who were prepared to start an apprenticeship, but there's no spots for them. So they go do something else.
I think we need to get more people doing apprenticeships. You know, back when I was going through, there was this pressure to go to uni, right? To that's what you need to do to be successful. I don't think that's right at all. I mean, you know, a bricklayer.
Well, it's right for some people.
It is. It's right for some people, but some people, they want to be a tradie. Absolutely, we need more tradies. You know, a brickie now is getting paid $3,000 a day to lay bricks.
Yeah, I know. It's crazy.
And right? We wonder why we can't afford to build houses, or you know,
I wonder why inflation's going up.
Yeah. So I mean, if we want to actually get more kids in housing, we've got to increase supply.
Yeah, that's right.
And also, I really think home ownership is so important because it gives people a stake in the economy and they care more.
Yeah, to be honest, I've kind of given up on that myself. But yeah, a lot of good points there. You've got to build it from the ground up. And this is what the current government seems to have failed to realise, that you just got to somehow make more TAFE spots available, because you can say free TAFE all you like, but I can tell you, as someone who's really out there, who's working on sites, it's not changing anything. And the problem is, right, a lot of these immigrants, right, the skills are just not up to it. Like, they just don't have the same training as this. And look, I'll be the first person to say, right, like, I know guys that are first-year apprentices, young guys I've worked with at the moment, and the money's pretty bad. Like, compared to, like, what you could get even as a fourth year, or like, even if I offered him like cashy to come and do a job here laying gyprock or something, like, do you know what I mean? Like, it is a bit, I think that's something we probably going to look at. So what do you think your party can do about those kinds of things, cost of living, housing?
Well, the best thing, Labor keeps saying that the inflation is not their problem. Right. It's a global issue. It's not true. The biggest impact on inflation is government spending.
That's right.
We need to reduce government spending, wasteful government spending. We need to be spending it in the right areas. So we need to, you know, we need to get rid of bloated bureaucracies. We need to cut government red tape. And we need to put pressure, downward pressure on inflation through cutting spending. You know, that's a critical element. To blame international factors is lazy on Labor's behalf. It's their policies that are causing it. If you mentioned before about migration, we need skilled migration. But if you're going to bring migrants in, you've got to have places for them to live. And basic supply and demand. If you have so much demand for housing but not enough supply, you're going to have an increase in prices. So we need to increase supply of housing. And that's what Peter Dutton's outlined, a $5 billion plan to unlock about 500,000 houses through actually encouraging more developers to develop. So we need practical examples or practical policies to help. And ultimately, if you're not in politics to help people and make life easier and get government out of the way, why are you here?
Very good question. I'd like to ask a lot of people on the Hill.
I'm here to help. I'm here for, because I have a sense of service that's been instilled in me from a very young age.
And you know, the interesting thing, so like I said, this is like a hobby for me, right, following campaigns. So to have, like, you know, to be able to have access to you guys has been really cool on this campaign. And one thing that I'm finding, right, is like, don't worry, I haven't recorded podcasts before, but on other campaigns I've gone and talked to other politicians, right, and like I've really noticed a difference between the last batch and this batch, right? And one thing I've also noticed is that people, I think, unfairly seem to judge politicians really heavily based on who came before them. Now, you wouldn't do it to your football team, do you know what I mean? But why do you think people do that to politicians and think it's okay to shit on politicians?
Well, I mean, they have a democratic right to say whatever they like, right? We need to listen to their concerns. I think there's a degree of frustration in with politicians. You know, what are you there for? Why do you want to do it? What's your motivation? You know, so there is, I think, a healthy skepticism. But I think, you know, at least from my perspective, I'm going out and meeting as many people as possible and door knocking, including in very hot weather, because I actually have a genuine interest in understanding how I can help. And the other thing that one of the senior shadow ministers came out, assistant ministers came out, and he said, you know what, when people hear like we're going to commit $300 million to increase a road or to lengthen a road, people's eyes sort of glaze over. But if you go, actually, I'm going to invest $500,000 to fix a change room, to make your community centre better, to fix a dangerous intersection that actually is going to impact on your life and help you, that resonates more.
Yeah.
I think we need to get back to the basics of what are the projects that we can do to help you and make your life easier? What are the aged care facilities that we need to build? Like my mum, dad lives in 2J, mum's in Northam, they're still married, but they're 84. Dad couldn't look after mum anymore because she's got dementia. So she's in residential care in Northam. Now, that's a long way to go for dad and for me, but there's just not enough places in Kalamunda, for example. I think we're 300 beds short. So what are we doing? What can we do to help increase that or fix that problem or, you know, fix the mobile black spots that you can't drive around Carmel, Kalamunda, Gidgegan up anywhere for more than 2 minutes without losing reception.
And just go down to the bathroom.
Yeah. Or the bushfire brigades who, you know, all these volunteers, they don't have fit for purpose facilities to do what they need to do. You know, I think we just need to focus on policies that help local communities. And when people can see politicians care and they want to help and they want to fix problems, then we might actually have less people having a crack at pollies.
Yeah, it's one of those things. It's tricky because, like, I just tend to judge people based on, you know, this. I don't have preconceived ideas, but I know it's like the vitriol, you know, a lot of people spew because of ideology and all that kind of stuff. And I say, I'm just trying to remain objective. But honestly, I do see, I can tell you, this batch, you guys, you're different. You're not the same as the ones that came before. And I really do see that. And, you know, like, you know, I've met you a couple of times now, Lisa, several times at the markets and around town, Adam, you know, several times. And yeah, I just see them as Mike, you know, fully, you know, approachable people that are prepared to listen. And, you know, teach my son all the time, you know, if more people would engage in politics, we would get better, much better results. So yeah, I think a change is coming. How do you think you'll go realistically coming up? I mean, let's be honest, I'd say Mayor's probably some other people. Look, the Labor candidate, they'll get some rusted on votes, but actually, I don't really see him in the race. I see it coming down to you and me. What do you think about that?
I'm running my own race, to be honest, and I'm focusing on my own campaign.
That's a fucking good politician.
It's the honest truth, because you need to focus on your own actions and behaviours and do your best and meet as many people as you can. And the voters will make their own decision. I don't know what's going to happen. All I can control is my own campaign. And my campaign is getting out there and meeting as many people as I can and listening. And the single message I'm getting, people are not happy with Albanese. The biggest issue is cost of living, and they want to know how we're going to fix it.
Exhibit A, Your Honour. Right? And what I mean by that is, this is exactly what I'm talking about. In the past, the candidates would have said, oh, fuck Mia, she's this, she's that, rah, 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 she hasn't done that. Whereas, like, and one thing that politicians don't seem to, the old batch don't seem to have realised, right, is that the negative campaign doesn't work anymore, right? And if you notice, if you follow American politics closely, right, the difference between the first Trump campaign and the second one was unbelievable. And even at the start, I could tell straight away, I was saying, Kai, what's his speech? Like, any chance to, like, be anything negative, he just didn't buy into it. Because, you know what, people just don't like it. And even, like, you know, you've had a few opportunities here today where you could have, like, got the knives out, and this is what I'm talking about, Exhibit A, you haven't. And this is what I see from Adam and also Lisa and the other candidates, you know, that I've talked to. And this is sort of what gives me hope, because I think people are realising that, yeah, just focus on your policies, focus on doing a job. Because let me tell you about the negative stuff, right? No one fucking cares. No one cares about celebrity endorsements or any of that kind of stuff.
They want hope. They want to be able to trust the politicians. They want to be able to go to them with a problem, and they want to at least be heard, and to try and help. And that's what I said. It's a sense of service that motivates me.
Yeah.
And I hope that I can bring positive change to Bullwinkle.
Well, a couple of quick things I'm going to ask you, and then we'll wrap it up. What are your thoughts about a republic? I'm going a bit down off the tangent here, your party guy, Ron, but I'd just be interested to know what this new batch, what do you think?
Interesting you ask, because at the last election, when Labor won, there was an assistant minister for the Republic.
Yeah.
Right? Now, then they did The Voice, and The Voice was resoundingly defeated. That ministerial position disappeared, gone.
Mm.
Right? Because they went, well, we're not going to win another, we're not going to even try and go into another referendum. And so I don't think it'll happen anytime soon, because you'll need another referendum for it to happen. And I think governments of all persuasions, after the last result,
can't afford to lose.
Won't want to touch it. And
yeah, good.
And I'm just being honest, practical about it. I just don't think anyone's going to touch it.
What about in the future? Let's say a couple of terms down the road.
I don't know. I don't think it's a priority.
Yeah.
You know, people care about cost of living and housing. We're getting back to basic politics here.
Mm-hmm.
We're not talking about republic. No, who's talking about a republic? Who's talking? Yeah. I mean,
I'll tell you what sort of led to that question, right? So, I probably identify more as like a libertarian, right? And that's a lot of my close friends. Like, basically, we've given up, right, on terms of like being able to live somewhere when you're free, because basically what a libertarian believes, right? And here's the thing, right? Everyone's actually libertarian. They just don't realize it, right? Because if you go up and down the street and knock on houses and you ask everybody this question, right, you won't find anybody that will say no, right? So what a libertarian believes is that you should basically be able to free to live your life as you see fit, as long as you are not harming another human being.
All government, minimal intervention.
Yes, right? So I've kind of realized that this two-party system that we've got that's over 1,000 years old now, to people like me, right, it doesn't work. And now I won't bore you with stories, but I've tried to like get shit done in the past and put a phenomenal amount of work into it. And like one thing which we could talk about later maybe, but pardon me, is like opening up the dams for fishing, right? I won't even go into it. It's a whole nother podcast, right? But basically they beat the fuck out of me, right? And you just realize like this system just doesn't work. So there's a whole bunch of us, right, who kind of feel, excuse me, that we've moved on from that, and we're looking for something better, and we're looking for, you know, and sometimes I think like, oh, we're overreacting, right? And then like, I'll give you a perfect example, right? The whole thing that's going on with the guns now, right? It's got nothing to do with the guns. It's got to do with the fact that, first of all, right, these are completely legally purchased items that are now being mandatory taken from the government. It's not a buyback. They can call it whatever the fuck they like, right? I got mates that spent $2,500 on a Glock and they offered them $400. That's fucking theft, right? How the fuck does this happen in 2025, right? Now you can see the libertarian coming out of me, right? And then other times I go, you know what? Australia's pretty good. Like, what are we worried about? There are, like you said, there's other priorities. But I just feel, look, I think this is why we have elections, so that we can really balance things. Because at the moment, if you sort of think the way that I do, it feels like Australia's slipping away from you.
I think people are focused on basics now. I think people are focused on just getting by. I think also what we've seen, obviously on federal, those issues are state, but we've seen the danger of one party that controls both houses.
Yeah.
You need checks and balances, yeah. Because if you don't have checks and balances, you have a higher chance of having bad policies put in place. And that's where the media has an important role to play. That's where an opposition has an important role to play. You know, we live in an amazing country. We live in a democratic nation. We need to have politicians that stand up and fight for their community. And we need a strong Liberal Party.
Yeah, well, look, I'll push back on it and say, you know, democracy works. And I'll give you an example. So at the moment, right, I haven't checked, but there's about 50,000 members of the Labor Party in WA, right? There's 90,000 gun owners. Right now, you know where this is going. Right, all those gun owners have to do is all join the Labor Party and vote all those candidates out. Democracy working, right? But they won't do it. Why won't they do it? It's because I reckon apathy. And what you said, you know, people are struggling, but I also think Australia maybe life's a little bit too good in some ways. Because you've got to remember, right, if you earn the minimum wage in Australia, right, and I had to look this up because I was going around saying 3%, right, and it's actually wrong. If you earn the minimum wage in Australia, you're in the top 1% in the world. I think it's important to keep that in perspective when you're bitching about the government. What do you think?
As I said, we're very fortunate and lucky to live in Australia.
Yeah.
I wouldn't want to live anywhere else.
No. I think when you go down the rabbit hole, you realise there's stuff wrong with it, but... You know, I see a bit of a wind of change, you know, and I really do think that the next generation coming along, from what I've seen from all the candidates so far, yeah, I've been seriously impressed, you know, and everyone's approachable, using things as an opportunity to learn rather than stick the knives in. And I think if you just, you know, if I may give you some advice, like, look, I'm telling you what you already know anyway, but just stick to that. People don't like the negative. They couldn't care less about it. You know what I mean? So
they want to know how you're going to help them.
Exactly, exactly. All right, mate. Well, I think that's pretty good. That's about now. So we're wrapping up. I'm pretty sure I managed to get through everything there. Oh, one, two little quick things. I want to ask you that, but just about the army, right? Best bit, worst bit?
Best bit, mates. Worst bit, doing a 40K pack march in Townsville as part of pre-deployment training for Afghanistan, but I finished it.
But you still remembered it.
I remembered it well. A lot of people didn't finish it, but the public affairs officer and the lawyer finished it.
Marcus Aurelius, the obstacle is the way.
Yeah, well, I mean, what do they say? There's a line about, one of my army mates said on his screensaver, it says, just a little bit further. Just a little bit further.
Yeah. Well, I like the fact that you've done the whole army thing because I think it gives you a whole different perspective that other people just, it's a skill other people just don't have. So, yeah, anyway, I'll be watching closely on the day and wish you all the best. And just want to thank you very much for giving me some time today. I realise that you're in the middle of a campaign. Actually, just sit there for a sec because I've got something for you. So everyone that comes gets something out of our garden.
He's opening the fridge. Oh, wow. How cool. Oh, that's amazing. We got everything. We got garlic, tomatoes.
And I wish I could say these are mine, but they're not. But these are the most beautiful eggs you'll ever have.
Oh, wow.
A friend of mine that lives around the corner has got like heritage chickens.
Oh, mate, that's amazing.
This is me in a tray.
Oh, that is so beautiful. And it's nice and cool as well.
Yeah, it's been in the fridge, man. So, yeah.
Thank you very much. I really appreciate it.
Just a little bit of a show of appreciation, so I'll chuck it in.
Thank you. Great. Awesome, well, man. Thanks very much.
Yeah, no worries. It's been that way.
Cheers.
Thank you very much for your time. Wisdom supremacy, intense chemistry, they expect the list when we sound the list. Wisdom supremacy, intense chemistry, best be aware. Intense chemistry, they expect the list when we sound the list. Western supremacy, intense chemistry. Best be aware.